This talk by Noah Levine was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles, California, and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
Buddhism could be said that it both starts and ends with understanding the way it is, or wisdom about the way it is. This investigation of impermanence really is the beginning, core, important, maybe most important on some level, central issue that we have to understand. But actually, maybe it's just semantics. But we all already understand it, right? The beginning, you understand it. We could go outside and ask anybody on the street walking by that aren't super spiritual meditators like you guys. We could ask any ordinary civilian, does everything change? And pretty much anybody would say yes. Everybody gets, at least intellectually, that yeah, life is a process and everything changes. But it's much different to know that than to live in harmony with that truth. And I think that that's the difference between understanding impermanence and having wisdom about impermanence. And that what Buddhism seeks is to end suffering and to see how central to our suffering is the truth of change, of impermanence. And to then have wisdom into how do I live in this impermanent, constantly changing, always ending experience where every single experience is coming to an end. Every relationship is constantly changing. Every moment, every breath, every sensation, every sound. So moving from just intellectually understanding it to really knowing it. And it's why we call this form of meditation insight meditation. Having insight into it, not just knowing it, but seeing into it, seeing clearly, knowing it. Living in harmony, insightfully, in relationship to the impermanent nature of life. And I guess that a big part of it was like, okay, well, everything changes, no big deal. Why is it such a problem? And the main problem seems to be attachment. Impermanence itself doesn't hurt, does it? The fact that everything ends, every relationship ends in death or some other form of death of every relationship. It's not the fact that everything ends, every experience, every sound, every book, every meditation. It's not ending, it's that we don't want it to end. It's the lack of acceptance or the attachment or resistance that's truly the problem, isn't it? Is that the problem in your life? Your lack of acceptance of impermanence? And maybe this is the sort of wisdom perspective that sometimes the Buddha talks about the difference between those of us who are really trying to understand reality and trying to awaken, and he has a term that's used a lot where he says the untrained worldlings. You know, the people who aren't even trying to wake up, just aren't even trying to train their mind. That actually think it's impermanence that's the problem. It's the fact that everything changes, that's the problem. It's not the fact that I'm trying to stop impermanence. It's not that I'm holding on. Of course I'm holding on, that's not the problem. It's just if I could just get life to stop changing so much, then I'd be happy. And maybe that's a popular delusion. But of course the wisdom perspective, or at least the Buddhist wisdom perspective, is that it's impermanence isn't the problem. It's our relationship to impermanence that completely dictates our well-being, our happiness, and our freedom. It's not the fact that everything ends. It's how do we grieve endings? How do we walk through this world where everything is ending, changing, where we can't hold on to anything? Most of you have heard the analogy that I like best, that it feels like to me, where attachment in this impermanent world always results in rope burns. Because anything that we cling to is changing. So as soon as we grab on to him, to her, to the experience, to the car, the motorcycle, the job, the money, anything, it's being pulled beyond our grasp. We can't hold on to it. We can't stop it from changing. We can't stop them from changing. On the external, and then on the internal, we have, even in meditation, you can create a lot of suffering for yourself. You had that one really pleasant meditation, but you just couldn't hold on to it. Trying to get back to that place where you just felt like everything was okay for a minute. It was such a relief. And we create suffering about that too. Craving for it. Clinging. And it's pulled. It's gone. That pleasant meditation that you had last week might not be here tonight. And you might be really pissed off about it. Might really be suffering about the change. Insight that we're looking for is again very clearly has a purpose in Buddhism, which is to end suffering. This isn't about like, yeah, you'll be super smart if you know about impermanence. This is very practical. We can suffer less. We can be happier and more content if we see it clearly. If we accept the way that it is, clearly. Everything is changing all of the time. Attachment always causes suffering. And trying to resist is futile. Our other, when life is pleasant, impermanent experiences are pleasant, we tend to cling. It's part of our survival instinct. It's built into us. We cling to it. We want to hold on to it. We crave for more pleasure, and we crave for less pain. But pain also is impermanent. And it feels a bit like there's this impermanent flow of sensation or experience in life. And impermanence is really quite a good news when life's painful. And if we have enough wisdom to understand life is going to be painful sometimes, but it's impermanent, and we let it come through our experience and pass, then pain arises and passes. But without training Our biological survival instinct, I believe, is to meet pain with aversion, to block it. And so then we create a dam, a blockage in the flow. And so then not only does it not work, right? When you meet your pain with hatred, with aversion, when you say, I don't want to fucking feel this. Not only does it not really work, it just makes it hang around longer. You kind of are saying like, okay, just stay right there inside my heart for the rest of my life. I'm just going to suppress that. Instead of just letting it go. Instead of just letting it come through. So impermanence isn't all bad news. It's actually quite good news. Maybe half of the time. If we're lucky, half of the time, I think. And if we have some inkling of wisdom and some level of mindful training, of rewiring our relationship to the impermanent pains and the impermanent pleasures of life. The Chinese Buddhist / Taoist practitioners, the Shaolin and the Wu Tang, you know, those guys. Took to having a saying that life is 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. And, you know, it's really kind of more Taoist, and it's more, it's not actually from the Buddha, but it's more the yin and the yang, right? There's the pleasant and there's the unpleasant. There's the joy and there's the sorrow in life. If we're lucky, we have that kind of balance. That's the ideal, is that you will only have sorrow half of the time if you're lucky. That would be, you know, that would be good if life was only unpleasant 50% of the time. You'd be close to enlightenment. I think that this is incredibly important, that often we have this idea that if we're Buddhist enough, if we're spiritual enough, life will be only joy, no more sorrow. Life will be only pleasure, no more pain. The pleasure will become permanent. And the pain will just be the only thing that's impermanent from now on. The pleasure will come and it will stay, and the pain, it'll just disappear. Definitely not a Buddhist concept, that delusion. That idea that we're going to be able to create a life that's all pleasure all the time. Just living in an impermanent world, even for enlightened beings, is difficult. Is unpleasant at times. Just living in one of these bodies with its nervous system, all of its sensitivities, it's unpleasant sometimes. The nirvana of the Buddha, the enlightenment of the Buddha, isn't constant pleasure. It's constant wisdom. It's the wisdom that everything is changing, and so clinging to anything is irrational, is dysfunctional, is delusional to think that holding on to any impermanent experience is going to bring happiness. And so the wisdom knows my life practice is to let go of everything all of the time. And therefore not suffer about it. And also the enlightened heart, mind, the wisdom knows that pain is inevitable. We're going to stub our toes. And we're going to have our egos bruised and our hearts broken. And there's going to be pain physically and emotionally. It's going to happen. Unavoidable, inevitable, and impermanent. The good news. It's going to change. And that actually this whole thing that we call life, you know, in this body, only has one destination, and it is death, and it is decay. And all of the stuff that we're so worried about holding on to, our images and our bodies themselves and our accomplishments and our relationships, we can't take any of it with us. We reflected in the beginning about what would we miss most? What's the hardest to let go of in this impermanent life? If we were to die tomorrow, if that was it. Another way to do that, to reflect, I think that very important for spiritually minded people, what is my greatest accomplishment in this life? What am I sort of most, if I were to die tomorrow, what's been most important use of my time, my accomplishments in this life? Is it the stuff? Is it the bank account? Does that really matter if you're going to die tomorrow? Is it the attention that you got, or the relationships that you had or you didn't have? Or is it the amount of wisdom and compassion that you were able to develop in this life? On your deathbed, what's going to be most important? Is it the ability to be mindful and to let go? To be compassionate and to be forgiving? We forget about this, and we tend to take life for granted, don't we? Kind of think like, well, I got plenty of time. I'll do that retreat next year. And hopefully it's true. Hopefully we all have plenty of time. But what's clear is that death is certain. And that the time of death is uncertain. That there is no certainty, there's no promise that it's going to, that we do have next year. Or that we even have another breath after this one right now. And it's definitely one of the reasons why the Buddha introduced this reflection on impermanence and in death from the beginning of the meditation instructions. The first foundation of mindfulness, right after directing us to pay attention to our breath. The Buddha directs us to pay attention to death, to the impermanence of the body. To bring about that understanding of the preciousness and the encouragement to not waste our time. Because we don't know how much time we have. What we do know is that these bodies aren't going to last. And what we do know, or will know, is that when it comes to death and to life, what's going to be most valuable is not our material accomplishments, but our wisdom, our spiritual understanding. The Japanese Zen tradition, somewhere along the line, came up with the saying, "Meditate like your hair is on fire." Easy for a bunch of bald monks to say. But to put that sort of urgency. Put that kind of urgency into our practice. Because of the truth of the impermanent nature of these bodies. And you think, then there's a bigger conversation that we could get into about reincarnation, rebirth. Of course, from a Buddhist perspective, it's not just this one body or this one life. But that this body, this impermanent body that we have, it's thought to be incredibly rare and precious to take human birth. That there's all of these other destinations that we could have been born into, all of the animal realms. That actually your essence could have just as well been a mosquito as a human being. That actually you have the potential, based on your own actions, to take birth not only as a human being. You know, sometimes we start talking about, oh, in my past life. You notice how in people's past lives they were always human beings? Right? In my past life, I was a Roman soldier. I was a great gladiator. From a Buddhist perspective, actually, human life is a rare destination. And then it's more likely to enter into a different type of existence than the human existence. And then within the human existence, it's considered to be incredibly rare to find what we call, you know, we would say Buddhist-centric view, we would say to find the Dharma. But even just opening that up, to find a true and valid liberating spiritual path, whether it's called Buddhism or called the Dharma or not, but something that actually has the potential to free you from suffering. Rare and precious. And I say that because I'm not sure that Buddhism is the only valid spiritual path, but to find a valid spiritual path, really rare. To be born into and then not only to find it, but to want it. And then to not only want it, but to be willing to follow through with the discipline of spiritual practice. Incredibly rare. Of the millions and billions of people, even of the billions of people that might call themselves Buddhists, how many and who want it and who understand it and are born into this ability to hear transformative teachings, how many are actually doing it, are actually meditating, are actually putting a lot of effort into changing their relationship to impermanence? Very few, actually. I heard at one point, I don't know if this is a true statistic, but I heard at one point that only 10% of Buddhist monastics meditate every day. Of the thousands, of the tens and thousands of people who have renounced the world and taken on robes in a religious Buddhist renunciation, only a very small percentage of them are actually following the Buddha's instructions as it was originally, which is you have to meditate to get enlightened. Enlightenment's not going to come from making incense offerings to statues. The Buddha was pretty clear about that. Which is what most Buddhists now do. They make, trying to make merits and they make offerings, but they're not actually following. Offering incense is not going to change your relationship to impermanence. Maybe it will. See, as it burns down, I don't know. So of course this is just an encouragement to understand that we have a great opportunity to what we call the precious human rebirth. You know, maybe some of you are like, I just came to check out meditation. I'm not sure what this fucker's talking about. because it is a little bit of a sort of religious fervor that I'm having here. But it just feels so important. And I don't even know why. It's not like one of my friends died this week or something. And nothing like that happened. I'm just... it's just what's on my mind is the importance of impermanence, what in Buddhism we call anicca, for our happiness, for transformation, and not only in the moment-to-moment and day-to-day, but the bigger picture, the impermanence of these bodies themselves. I remember I was teaching last year, and my wife was pregnant at the time. And I remember the first time I was doing a guided death meditation, a little bit like we did tonight. And for the first time, I consciously acknowledged that my unborn child was going to die. feeling that, like, wow, we're signing up for this. The cause of death is birth. For sure. If you're born, you die. And so often we feel so, like such victims when people die, and it feels like it's wrong somehow, especially if children die, or it feels like our death is wrong somehow. So clearly, the Buddha's wisdom is trying to encourage us to understand and to have wisdom into the truth that there's nothing wrong with death. It's not a punishment from some sort of punishing God. It's just a fact, like gravity, that everything is constantly changing, and that these bodies are fragile, and that they're subject to sickness and to old age and to death. And so we have the opportunity to meditate like our hair is on fire, with the sort of and we have to be careful. We don't want to get too urgent. We don't want to get too stressed out about our spiritual understanding or accomplishment. But it's very important to look at what place am I putting my practice? What kind of priority? If understanding that on our deathbed, what's going to be most important to us and everyone else around us is, and I liked what one person said, was that we've cleaned up our own messes, right? That we're not dying and leaving a mess for everyone else. And also, with what kind of wisdom, with what kind of compassion are we entering into the big impermanence, into the process? And so what are we doing on a daily basis to come into harmony with impermanence? You can't get there, like so many spiritual practices, just thinking about it's not enough. Faith is not enough. You can believe in impermanence all day long. It's not enough. It's an important step in the right direction. Meditation seems to be, and when I say meditation, I mean any kind of, not just sitting meditation, although formal sitting meditation, very important, but some kind of present time awareness, some kind of introspection. If you want to know your mind, sit down and observe your mind. If you want to know impermanence and have insight into it, sit down and observe the impermanent nature of all things. You will never find a solid, static, unchanging experience anywhere in this world. And this is a very key Buddhist understanding as well when it comes to the nature of self. Because in meditation, we can begin to feel like, okay, everything's changing except for me. And when I say me, not my body or my thoughts, but the witness, the consciousness that observes feels permanent. And it feels like it's the same witness, the same consciousness that was experiencing my past. And it feels like it's the same witness, consciousness, that will experience the future. But through investigation, through mindfulness, you will see for yourself that yourself is also impermanent. You can't think your way to that understanding, what in Buddhism we call anatta, or not-self. But even saying not-self is a wrong translation of anatta. What anatta actually means is that there's not a permanent self. Sometimes anatta and this sort of emptiness gets translated as no self. It's an incorrect translation. What the Buddha said and experienced was that there is no permanent self. Very different to think about, because then sometimes Eastern traditions and you don't exist. You know, it's all an illusion. That's not what the Buddha said. That's not what Buddhism teaches, that there is no self, that there is no permanent self. That the self, you, me, is an unfolding process. It's not static, it's not solid, it's not separate and continuous. It arises out of causes and conditions, and it constantly is changing. Even though the smoke and mirrors of our mind, without deep meditative training, create a sense of solidity out of the self. Create a feeling of permanence out of the self, out of the feeling of me and mine and I. We create it through the lack of wisdom in our minds. But as wisdom develops, we see even that sense of self is an impermanent phenomenon. It's constantly changing. The impersonal nature becomes more and more clear as the impermanent nature becomes more and more clear. So this is where anicca, impermanence, is so connected to anatta. And as we talked about a little bit before, also all suffering connected to anatta, to anicca, to impermanence. We're suffering because we're trying to hold on to something we can't hold on to, or we're trying to get rid of something that we can't get rid of. So just stop doing that and you'll stop suffering. Simple. And that's why we meditate, and that's why we try to come into a life that is one of wisdom. One of seeing life clearly as it is, not as we wish it were or want it to be, but really this is the way it is. These aren't philosophies. Sometimes they say Buddhism is a philosophy. It's not a philosophy. These are facts. These are scientific, proven facts. Everything changes, period. It's not a philosophy. It's not an idea. It's 100% the way it is. Just like gravity. It's the way it is. So those are most of my thoughts about impermanence tonight. I'd like to have some conversation. I'll clarify one thing. Maybe it's on somebody's mind. Right? If everything's impermanent, and so our practice is to be non-attached, then what about relationships? I don't know if that's on anybody's mind. Right? Aren't we supposed to kind of be a bit attached? Aren't I supposed to be a bit attached to my wife, to my daughter, to our relationships? So the ideal, the Buddhist ideal for this, and it's an elusive ideal, I'll admit, is connected non-attachment. Buddhism is not encouraging detachment or separateness from each other. It's actually, when it comes to intimate relationships, the goal is connected, you and them, connected. Right? This is attachment. This, nobody likes this. Well, it's nice for a moment, for a short hug. All right? But nobody likes it when you try to control them. He doesn't like it. She doesn't like it. Nobody likes it when you try to hold on to them and control them and not let them be their own impermanent process. Clinging is not necessary in relationships. It's natural. It's a default. It's not healthy. It doesn't create happiness. And so, but also, this is non-attachment. But sometimes we're deluded and we think that this is non-attachment. Separateness from, right? And we kind of detach. Very different being detached from each other than being connected non-attached. Very different. present with each other without trying to control, without clinging. Very different. So I think that that's important. I think that that's very important. Clarification that our goal is connected, present, non-clinging, not detached separateness. What are your thoughts or questions, or how do you work with impermanence in your life? And also with this sort of death awareness. And how does that motivate you or not? Yeah, please.
Well, I have sort of a question. I don't know if it's too much to get into the discussion period, but would be the ideal of equanimity with impermanence. This, could you just define it a little bit for everybody that hasn't heard it defined before, but also discuss how that helps us with these the parts of impermanence that are in fact challenging. And just there's things that that just happen, and that's, you know, the sun goes down. But, you know, the end of a relationship, or the death of a loved one, or health slipping away from you. You can be wise about these things happening, but how do you achieve equanimity that suffering-free comfort point?
Yeah. Well, do you understand his question? I think that the biggest thing that I feel like I didn't, as you asked the question, I feel like I didn't talk about enough is compassion. Is that life is going to be painful. There is going to be the 10,000 sorrows. And the appropriate response is not only non-aversiveness to the pain of loss and grief, but also is compassion and is mercy and is kindness and friendliness and is equanimity. And that it's actually, equanimity is created by the balance of non-attachment and compassion. So the more we learn to let go, to release our attachment, and to respond to the pain with compassion, the more equanimous we are. I recently got a phone call, and maybe this is why it's on my mind, although I hadn't really thought about it. But I did recently get a phone call from a friend who said, a mutual friend, maybe had a terminal diagnosis. And she said, afterwards, she said, "You're so equanimous about it." I felt very sad, but I just also felt compassion and understanding the impermanent nature of bodies. And, I didn't feel dramatic about it. You know? I felt equanimous. And then about 4 hours later, called me back and said, "Actually, it sounds like maybe it was a misdiagnosis. Maybe not terminal at all." And I said, "You know, okay. That would be better news." But I sort of received it a bit the same way. There's a Chinese story. My father, I think it was in Gradual Awakening, his book on meditation, where he talked about the Chinese village farmer who was kind of, you know, having to plow his fields by hand. And one day somebody gave him a horse. And the whole village said, "What a blessing. Now you have a horse to help plow your fields and you're going to be that much more productive and you'll make that much more rice and money or whatever." And this wise man said, "We'll see whether it's a blessing or not." And then his son was riding the horse and plowing the fields and helping him and broke his leg, fell off the horse and got bucked off and broke his leg. And then everyone in the village said, "What a curse that fucking horse was." All right, you got that horse and it, you know, has now it's broken your son's leg and he can't help you and you have to do all the work. What a curse. And then the next week, the army came through town and took all of the able-bodied young men off to die in war. And again, everyone said, "What a blessing that horse was, because your son broke his leg and now he doesn't have to go off to war." And each time the sort of story keeps going, the wise person said, with equanimity, "We'll see. We don't know whether this is a blessing or a curse." Because of the wisdom of impermanence and because of the compassion, that's when equanimity naturally comes. In the Brahma Viharas, equanimity is the balancing factor of wishing kindness towards all living beings and wishing compassion towards all living beings, with the understanding, then the Buddha says, now if you're going to wish compassion towards all living beings, don't get deluded here. Your equanimity, your balance will come from understanding that everyone's happiness depends on their actions, not your wishes. So have a balanced heart. Have a balanced mind. Be equanimous with the understanding that you're not in control of them. You're responsible for your actions, for your happiness. And of course, we are connected and we are responsible to each other, and we do have some limited ability to help each other, to inspire and protect and encourage. But ultimately, no matter how much we wish for other people to stop suffering, we can't stop the core internal attachment and aversion that causes suffering. Everyone has to do that work for themselves. So equanimity is incredibly important and a byproduct of non-attachment and compassion. What else? Anything? Please.
You said something, now I'll sort of try to paraphrase and then you can correct it. But you're talking about sort of at the end of our lives that the most important thing would be sort of how much we had learned, kind of, something like that. And my gut reaction to that is bullshit. Because if it ends with me dying, which I believe probably is the case, then it seems like what's the point of it, the learning, if it just ends? And it seems like, to me, it's more about what you sort of pass on?
Legacy, or...
Yeah, not like a will or something, but sort of...
Sure.
I mean, it's one of my...
Who have you helped? Have you loved well?
Or I haven't had children, or I haven't created a great piece of art, or something like that, so what am I going to leave? That kind of thing, so it's a thought I have sometimes. But it seems to be that's the value of sort of the existence, is that what you kind of pass on.
Yeah.
I just wonder what your thoughts were about that.
Well, there's a couple of... I mean, and it is basically what I said. I was proposing that... the way that we're going to be dying and the kind of level of suffering that we're going to be in is going to depend not so much on what we've learned, but I guess what we've learned, how much wisdom and compassion we have. And so it's going to be very important to how unpleasant that dying process may or may not be. It was part of the proposal. And then, of course, from a Buddhist perspective, it's also very important because it's going to depend on your next incarnation. It's going to depend on what kind of wisdom and compassion you've developed in this lifetime, what kind of understanding you've come to, and that the sort of destination of your rebirth, if you believe in this type of thing, depends completely on your actions and your wisdom and how much greed, hatred, and delusion you have left in your system at death. Right? And the kind of if you're completely free from greed, hatred, and delusion, then nirvana is your destination, both in this lifetime and after the body. And if you're not finished, then you take rebirth because you have more work to do. And so that's very Buddhist-centric sort of view there. But I think that there's definitely some truth to what you say about maybe a big part of what is important is the legacy, or kind of what we leave, for not materially perhaps, but how have we affected this world in a positive way is what I took from what you said. And I think that that's very important also. And I believe that if wisdom and compassion is our priority, that what we will leave is a legacy of wisdom and compassion, of people who felt loved, felt seen, felt appreciated, and benefited from your presence. And it's that way in which I think actually our spiritual awakening isn't a selfish endeavor just for us, but actually benefits everyone, friends, family, maybe even our society. And you look at, you know, in history, the kind of someone like Siddhartha Gautama that was so wise and so compassionate that even 2,500 years later, on the other side of the planet, we're still talking about him, right? And there's that kind of legacy. And he didn't do it for that intention. He did it, well, maybe there was some of that intention, but mostly he said he did it to find the end of suffering in his life. And through finding the kind of wisdom that ended suffering in his life, he was then able to lead so many millions of people towards that kind of goal. So huge legacy, right? Huge. So there's that potential. But with everything that I say, you know, if you have that internal reaction of like, kind of, oh, bullshit, honor that too. And I totally encourage you. To benefit from Buddhism?
Yeah.
No. You do not have to believe anything. I was listening to a talk the other day. Joseph Goldstein was talking about his first teacher, Manindra, when he was practicing in India. And he was talking about, Manindra was telling him all this stuff about the different realms and reincarnation. And he said to him, he said, you know, Joseph, you don't have to believe any of this. It's totally true. It's the way that it is. But you don't have to believe any of it. And so I think that that's sort of the attitude in Buddhism is like, and the Buddha's attitude is that he would give these lectures and he would say, this is the truth. This is the way it is. You don't have to believe it. You should find out the truth for yourself. Don't believe my truth. Don't believe what I know to be true. You should find out. You should trust your deepest wisdom. Now, the caveat to that is don't trust your discursive thinking. Don't trust your untrained worldling mind and, you know, and your college education. Trust, or high school education, or junior high, or however far you made it. Trust your, you know, a deeper, maybe what we'd even kind of call it a heart wisdom, rather than just my mind decided that this is true or not true. It takes some sort of training of the mind for it to become trustworthy. Ajahn Sumedho, one of the monastic lineage holders, said, sometimes people want to talk about Buddhism as this sort of like follow your heart or trust your bliss type of thing. And he said it's completely incorrect. Buddhism is not about following your heart or your mind. It's about training your heart and your mind. And once you've trained your heart and your mind, it will become trustworthy. And that's the wisdom that the Buddha is encouraging us to trust, not just our untrained mind. There was a hand somewhere. Yeah, Liz.
In the beginning of the meditation about the permanence of breathing and your guiding and being aware that everything changes, that all works. And then the be present. As soon as I heard that, I don't know, trickery, I was, well, it's over. You can be present, because as soon as you notice it, it's gone. So,
Well, that's maybe quite good insight. It's one of the reasons why I tend to use the term present time awareness. Sometimes, and maybe I said it tonight, and sometimes I slip up, and a lot of times meditation instructions say, pay attention to the present moment. And it's the insight that you had. It's impossible to pay attention to the present moment. It's already fucking gone. As soon as my attention alights on it, it's gone. It's there's no moment to pay attention to. There's only an experience of time unfolding. And so that's why I tend to say, now just be with the present time experience. Be mindful of the moment-to-moment unfolding of experience. Because what you saw is the truth. It's impossible. I can't, there's nothing, you know, there's nowhere to land when we talk about the present, except for watching the process unfold. So good, and keep playing with that, and keep observing that.
Last class, I had asked about sitting with a feeling or whatever we were experiencing at that time versus concentrating on our breath. And you were saying, don't whip yourself back to your breath, you know, sit with whatever. Yeah, I mean, like, outside of meditation in the real world, it's like, my question is, I can just use a real personal example. Like, the other night, I was feeling, like, I felt resentment coming up from another person that was deep-seated from a long time ago. And I didn't know if I should sit with that resentment, and I tried to, and it kind of, like, overtook me, and I said the wrong thing.
Mm-hmm.
Or, like, just be, like, focus on my breath and just ignore that feeling, you know? And don't even deal with that about totally say the wrong thing at that moment. Now, today, sitting here, I realize where that resentment comes from. This is 24 hours after that. What's a skillful way to deal with that feeling at the time? Like, should I just focus on my breath or sit with that feeling? I can't sit with it when we're having a conversation.
Mm-hmm. If you have the understanding about yourself, that if I'm feeling this resentment and if I open my mouth right now, I'm going to act on it unskillfully. If there's the sort of humility that knows, actually, I don't have the skill to have this conversation with this person right now. I need to investigate this a bit more, maybe do some forgiveness before I approach this person. Then kind of using the breath as a distraction is fine. As long as you come back to it like you did. Because as your experiment showed you, that, you know, you opened your mouth and it sounded like you said it didn't work out so well. So it's okay to postpone it. Totally okay to postpone it. As long as you come back to it. You just don't want to shove it down and ignore it forever.
And I guess in the relationship to her question, she made me think of it. When we're sitting in formal meditation, when that feeling of resentment still is kind of with me 24 hours later, should I just kind of like ruminate on it right now? Or
sure.
Just focus on my breath?
No, only use the breath to get here. The breath gets you here. It helps your mind get concentrated and to be in the present. Then your job is to open to what's happening. Not just to pay attention to the breath. What are the emotions that are present? What are the thoughts, the feelings? Okay, there's still this feeling of a bruised heart or an old resentment. Or let me just pay attention to that. Let me just experience that for a bit. And, you know, it's tricky because you don't want to ruminate. You don't want to think about it the whole time. But you do want to, I don't know what the right word is, maybe investigate. Analyzing a little bit, but without too much thought. Investigating as in looking deeply at what's arising rather than thinking about what's arising. Does that make sense? You'll find your way with it.
Present time awareness would just be kind of just sitting with it.
And when it passes, let it pass. Because that's the trap that we get into, is like kind of, well, it came and it went, and then I went after it and brought it back. Right? And so present time awareness is also acknowledging that even that resentment, it arose and it passed, and it's okay to let it go.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.